National media continues to exaggerate and promote misleading negative headlines designed to diminish the rule of law and those whose job it is to enforce it. Remember, the only people who want to defund the police and dismantle these agencies are the criminals. And don't forget to thank a cop. Now, let's start the show. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. Our guest today is Pima County Attorney Laura Conover. And we have an intern working with us this morning who's going to help us with the show, Emma Underwood. And thank you for being here, both of you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me back. I'm very pleased to be back, Sherry.
We have a lot to talk about, and basically the topic today is going to be about the Ashley bill that was turned down, didn't pass in the House. I want people to understand how the laws work from county to county to county, because it seems like there's some discrepancies in what happens up in the northern part of the state, not necessarily in the south. So I know you remember what happened with this bill. Can you explain to us what's going on with this?
Yeah, absolutely, Sherry. I can take us back to one of the most difficult moments I've had in the job so far, and it came pretty early on. It was my first participation as a county attorney up at the state legislature, and there was what's called a drug homicide bill that had been proposed, and the idea as it had been marketed was that it would help us and give us a new tool in the fight against fentanyl. The problem was that the bill as written was going to make the transfer of any narcotic, okay, so let's break it down right there, not sale, but transfer, we'll get into that, of any narcotic, not just fentanyl, that leads to another person's death within the next 24 hours, a homicide with mandatory minimum of prison. And by that time, I had been in office long enough that I had already seen a few cases where a spouse, a sibling, a best friend is supplying a loved one who is near death, chronic pain, you know, horrifying pain, and they're providing it. And the idea that this person might be held accountable for murder was not at all what the bill, you know, originally was aimed for. It was so broad.
So it doesn't specifically state, you know, unless somebody is in a near-death situation, it doesn't carve that out.
No, there were no exceptions. And the other problem as well that I explained to the legislature when I testified is I said, look, if we're talking about the transfer of any drug and then a death 24 hours later, then what happens at like a frat party where someone provides cocaine to everyone, and then a kid dies 24 hours later of like an alcohol poisoning overdose, but the cocaine is still in their system, and then you're tracking back to the party. You know, I said that this is a massive expansion with unintended consequences. And it was excruciating to try to explain all this, because a number of parents had just testified before me about the loss of their child to an opioid overdose. And the room was just filled with so much sadness and trauma and grief. And I addressed them first in my overwhelming sympathy and empathy for their loss. But I had to explain to the House Judiciary Committee that the bill wasn't anywhere near what the purpose of it might have been. And at that point, I also shared that in Pima County, I was already indicting people for manslaughter. In Pima County, if you know your product, your fentanyl product is potentially lethal, and we have the messages to prove that people know what their product is, and you're profiting off of that anyway, selling it anyway and profiting off of it, And that directly leads to a death, and then it's a fentanyl overdose. It's a fentanyl toxicity in the death certificate. Then we're gonna prosecute you for your actions, for the harm you committed in our community.
Okay, not all coroners apparently see things the same way, because I read where on that particular bill where the coroner said that they couldn't say it was fentanyl because that a person also had marijuana in their system.
And Sherry, that's what I heard, and I can't speak to other cases in other counties, but you know, following this bill, you know, I'm the kind of official that doesn't want to just say, too bad, I can't help you. I went up there and testified and said, you know, this bill doesn't work. And I said, but look, we're doing it in Pima County. We're holding people accountable in Pima County. And so from there, my people, my experts, both in my shop and my agency at the Pima County Attorney's Office and in law enforcement, the detectives we work with, they've been doing statewide trainings ever since on how to make this available statewide. I've consulted directly with the Maricopa County attorney on this, and we've provided resources and trainings ever since.
So you're moving forward with trying to hold people accountable. Just this particular bill is not going to fly the way it's written.
It just couldn't. It didn't make any traction. It was just so incredibly broad, and it was going to encapsulate and frankly put people at risk who shouldn't be at risk, at the exact same time that we were trying to extend the Good Samaritan bill, which says that we're not going to prosecute you for simple drug possession or paraphernalia when you call 911 to save a person's life, because we need people to call 911 the moment they suspect an overdose is happening. If you have Narcan on hand, and I made my office a public health credited distributed office, because we're right downtown, of course, and we supply it at resource fairs on the weekends and at night. We want you to use Narcan immediately. We want you to call 911 immediately, because every second counts, because an overdose can be reversed if in time. And we need to make sure that people aren't afraid to do that. They need to call 911 immediately.
And there are no consequences if you call 911. So that's a step in the right direction as far as I'm concerned. People need not be afraid. Emma, what do you find on your college campus when it comes to drugs?
Well, a few months ago, there was a car stopped coming into my school that had millions of dollars worth of fentanyl that the police stopped, and it was coming straight to where I go to school. And so I actually knew a kid who personally died from a fentanyl overdose. He thought it was an accident. He thought it was cocaine, but it wasn't. Mm. And like, coming from a child, like a student who knew him too, it was kind of like, it's such an accident, and just like the littlest bit can kill you. And like, I know a bunch of people who take Adderall, which is also a big concern, because you don't really know what's in that. You're kind of just getting it from wherever. Like, kids are kind of just desperate for the Adderall because it helps you with your studies and stuff. And so that's why it's scary, especially in a big college town who's like kind of known for like going out and like the Greek system. Because you don't really know what's pure and what's not pure. And we do a lot of programmings and stuff. Like, I'm in Greek life, and so we do a lot of programmings about fentanyl and drug use and all that. But like, it can only do so much, because it just kind of takes one person that you know for it to happen, for everyone to be like, oh, like, this is actually real.
I think, Sherry, you had DEA on not too long ago, and I know that they've worked really hard, and all of law enforcement has worked really hard on the phrase "one pill can kill," and that's, you know, and that's another useful phrase, because it is absolutely true. It is absolutely true that one pill can kill, even for someone who's been using, because you don't know, you never can be sure. Emma, that's just so smart of you. You never can be sure exactly what you're getting. People can often be sure that they don't know what they're selling. Which is why it's important to focus our resources on going after the larger scale suppliers that you just described. That's where we need to prioritize our work, is on these higher level dealers and suppliers who are profiting off of their trade.
You know, that's the other thing. I don't think if you put a bunch of pills in front of me, put a lineup of pills, I couldn't tell you what those pills were. If they were aspirin or, you know, Advil, I wouldn't be able to identify them. And, you know, to go out and, you know, somebody's having a midnight trunk sale of illegal drugs, how do you know? You don't. So, you know, you need to be careful. Even tell people, students especially, if you've got medication that you need, keep it locked up so nobody else is playing with it too.
Yeah.
And don't share your meds with anybody, and don't take theirs.
Right.
It's just not worth the chance.
Yes, exactly.
And I know Biden just had a meeting with China.
Mm.
What is your opinion on how do you think that's going to work? They're trying to get them to shut down some of these places that are sending the chemicals to Mexico that are making the drugs come up to America. How do you think that's going to work out?
Well, I have two reactions to that. You know, anytime we have work and policy work at the highest level at production is again getting at the root of where this is all coming from. But when we talk about root cause, we're always going to have to go back to American demand.
Right.
You know, and I think again, once again, Emma, you just really brilliantly highlighted it, is that there's this constant demand. You mentioned Adderall. There's a demand for easy fixes to harder problems. And that's, you know, that's behavioral, it's psychological. And we have to be getting at it at the very beginning. And that's also why my office is very devoted to work in the juvenile system and with children and trying to cut it off before it ever starts. So kids never get started on it.
What is Adderall? I've never heard of it.
I'm not exactly sure what it is specifically, but it's kind of what kids take, and there goes from doses from 5 milligrams to 50 milligrams, and it just kind of helps you focus. It's for ADHD mostly. It kind of just helps you focus. That's what kids use to do their homework. If people have tests the next day, they'll take Adderall to help them focus and get it all done.
What happened to a cup of coffee?
I know.
I was just going to say, it was Mountain Dew, I think. Is like, you know, so it's, guilty as charged here. Right. I think in my era, it was caffeine. Like, we pumped caffeine to try to write, to finish that essay all night.
Yeah.
And Adderall was the original hyperactivity that kids were prescribed, you know, properly. But now college kids are using it to stay up all night and finish the essay, finish the exam.
Yeah, kids will get it prescribed to them, and like someone will be like, oh, I have a prescription to Adderall, and then they will sell that. They will sell one pill I've seen people sell one pill for $50, and that's how some people make their money in college, is they get their Adderall prescriptions filled and they sell it to kids because they will buy it.
And where do you get a prescription for this?
It's your pharmacy. If you have ADHD, they can prescribe you with Adderall.
That you're blowing my mind. Just like some of these people, and we talked about that too, where you'll go to the dentist and they'll send you home with 100 painkillers that are addictive,
right.
And before you know it, you're back at the dentist for another prescription.
Right.
And, you know,
chronic pain. Absolutely. I during my professional career earlier in life, I worked with a lot of clients who had been severely injured on the job, or terrible car accident. And then that's the whole nationwide story of how our opioid epidemic began.
Started.
Right. And companies, extremely recklessly pushing their product, frankly.
Does a pharmacist, if not a pharmacist, does a doctor, if they prescribe something, do they get a kickback for that? How many times they prescribe something, or is there a way of tracking that?
I don't know off the top of my head. I know that it's part of the litigation that's been going on about the practices of of profiting off of, you know, reckless sales practices when it came to the quote unquote lawful opioids. And credit to my predecessor for leading the way in Arizona on opioid litigation that we were able to finish off in my first year. And so those funds are starting to arrive to Pima County to try to help us on the prevention end, because that's what we can't. I know this isn't what people want to hear, but at the end of the day, we cannot arrest or incarcerate ourselves out of illness. Yeah, yeah, we cannot. We have to, and it's the harder way, which is often how you know it's the right thing to do. You have to get at the root cause of illness if we're going to get anywhere.
Yeah, and being a drug addict is an illness.
Yeah, absolutely. Substance use disorder is illness. Mental health illness is illness. And the problem is the jail is not a hospital. Prison's not a hospital. And so our gut instinct to try to, you know, I hear these phrases that, you know, people just want to sweep the streets, just make it go away, just make these people go away. And the problem is they come right back worse off because they haven't been to a hospital. They've been to a jail or a prison facility, and they're worse off. We have to get at treatment. We have to invest in it. And I think there's a metro agreement for this. I think that makes Pima County different. Other places are really struggling because officials don't talk to each other and don't plan together. And we're very, very lucky here that city and county get together. We just got together again, I would say like 3 weeks ago, Sherry. Mayor, chair of the board, county administrator, chief of police, county health, public health, right? Got to be at the table, and myself, to continue to work at this cooperatively.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing that impressed me is, and I saw it on the news a couple of weeks ago, and I don't even think it was Tucson, it was someplace, and the lady called the police arrived for a medical situation. I said, why are you calling the police? Call an ambulance.
Right, right.
You know, mm-hmm, right. Police are not ambulance people.
And Sherry, that's a perfect moment to say that, you know, we long had a crisis line. We've been very fortunate here in Pima County that the crisis response center is here, the CRC, and now we've got the nationwide number. I'm always saying 988, right? If it's medical or a behavioral crisis happening in front of you, it's not 911, it's 988. And that it's beautiful that we have that number now. And it goes straight to our crisis mobile teams. Mobile teams can come out, or obviously ambulance can come out. And the crisis response center is no wrong door. They will take you in, period, which is incredible.
When they take you in, do they keep you? How does that work? What is the system? And does it depend on what your situation is, or explain it?
Absolutely. So let's back up just a second, and we'll picture a police officer on the street just doing his or her regular job and comes across a person in crisis. If the officer suspects it's substance use disorder, they can go straight to Kodak off of Fort Lowell, 24/7, 365, and it takes about 10 to 12 minutes to drop that person off there direct into treatment, and then the officer's back out on the street. If the officer is interacting with the person and the officer says, this is persistent, this is acute, this is looking like mental health, they can go straight to the crisis response center on the south side. That, Sherry, that's a 3 to 5 minute drop off. I've obviously personally done both of these on my many, many ride-alongs to see how it works, and it's amazing. The a secured gate opens up. The officer drives through to the back of the crisis response center off of Ajo. And then it's secured, and they have their own entrance. They turn over the person and a declaration of what they saw, what they observed. The nursing staff then offers them water and snacks, and the officer is back on the street in 3 to 5 minutes.
So is there a police report written? dictated?
No. Well, of course, it all depends. If they've just encountered the person suffering on the street and there's no, you know, crime going on, then no, there's nothing. If they want to do a long form complaint about some crime that they observed, they can do that. But that we're talking about the people, you know, living out in the street, open air homelessness, or wandering and in crisis.
So the reporting is done by the facility. They're the ones that keep track of any records.
Well, the officer swears out just a one sheet of, like, why am I here? Like,
right.
What did I observe about this person? Like, why have I brought this person here to help the medical staff know?
So they know it's not his in-laws. He's dropping off his in-laws trying to...
Right. Right. It's credible. You know, we train on this, you know, does this look persistent? Yes, this person appears to have been living out here for a long time. You know, is it acute? Meaning, like, is it very serious? You know, yes, they were talking to themselves. You know, seeing something that I can't see. That kind of thing going on. And the officer's back on the street in 3 to 5 minutes. If there's a medical issue going on with the patient that's just been dropped off. Keno South is the doors face each other, so they can go right into an ER if they need to get checked out. Otherwise, they can stay at the CRC for up to 24 hours and be observed and be fully evaluated. And then the hope is that we're connecting them with a service provider to intervene for them and to keep them off the street, to see what their needs are so that they don't end up right back where they were, as would happen if they're dumped out of the jail.
So is 24 hours a long enough period of time? I know I've heard where cases where, you know, somebody's got some kind of drug in their system and it takes more than 24 hours to get back to maybe normal.
Well, and certainly if we're talking about substance use disorder, you know, longer term detox and inpatient treatment is the key there. And you know, there's a whole continuum.
They have to be willing to do it, though.
They have to be willing to do it. That's right. That's
okay.
Right.
How often does that happen?
Yeah. Well, from a law enforcement perspective, you know, in our shop, our sense is that if we can intervene for one person, the efficiency question, the cost to the taxpayer is how many contacts they're having and we've interrupted. So in other words, we have a particular court called the Compass Court, and it's that's a dual diagnosis court, meaning there's substance use disorder and mental health. It's both, which is common, of course. You know, people will self-medicate to try to deal with their mental health issues, and so we pour a lot of resources into a small group of people, but one person in that Compass Court might have had 350 police contacts in the previous year. The savings to law enforcement, the savings to the community, the savings to our resources is just incredible. If you can turn that one life around, and obviously that's a beautiful thing to see.
Yeah, going at the root of the problem.
Right.
So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a few.
FBI and its partners encourage Americans to take proactive steps to enhance their cybersecurity during National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, an FBI program aimed at preparing students for careers in cybersecurity expands. The FBI Cyber STEM program is designed for high school students with an interest in cybersecurity and science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, or STEM. Heather Schuck of the FBI's Pittsburgh field office says the program was born in 2015 out of concerns over a future gap in qualified cybersecurity professionals.
We realized that the Pittsburgh AOR had developed into a technology hub, but we were having challenges hiring cyber-trained folks.
FBI Pittsburgh teamed up with the University of Pittsburgh so its curriculum could be modified for high school students.
The FBI participates in providing touch points to high school students to give them background on real FBI cases.
The program is currently offered in Pittsburgh, Miami, and Washington, D.C. field offices, and efforts to roll it out to other offices are underway. With FBI This Week, I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau.
Law Matters and Pima Federal Credit Union are hosting a free educational event on the topics of internet scams and how AI can impact your future. Join us at 10 a.m. on Saturday, December 2nd at Pima Federal Credit Union, located at 6850 North Oracle Road in Tucson. For more information and to sign up, visit lawmatters1030.org.
Law Matters wants you to know all phone and email scams follow the same basic pattern. A potential victim is contacted, they are given a compelling reason to act, and then they are told to pay money. In every scheme, there is an urgency factor. These scammers are professionals. They are using scripts that work. It is okay to hang up or tell a lie if you have to. Better yet, don't answer the phone if you don't recognize the number. If in doubt, reach out to a friend or a family member.
Thank you for staying with us. So, how hard is it to prove that the person who sold the drugs knew or didn't know that there was fentanyl in that drug?
Well, what's been incredible about these cases truly is the quality of the evidence that law enforcement are bringing to us, especially in what I'll just call messaging. And there's a number of different kinds of apps that are used to message back and forth, because that's what sellers are relying upon to get the connection, to arrange the time and place to meet. And so the evidence is so rich that the person knows what they're selling, they're basing cost or price off of what they have. And in our worst cases, Emma, they're bragging about how heavy the fentanyl is, or how and that their buyer should be, should go slow, and various phrases that show that the seller knows how toxic their product is and profiting off of it. And that was one of our very first cases that we had, where there were two juveniles buying from this woman. And the level of recklessness and kind of the power she had over the kids, was the first case that was real obvious that we needed to hold her accountable for how much harm she had caused.
Yeah. So has your cases resulting in fentanyl gone up, would you say? Like, have you seen more as the years go on?
I would say that these cases have kind of held steady. They are extreme. This is so crass and painful. But I think dealers aren't wanting their buyers to overdose, because they want to keep selling. And so these are really extreme cases that we're talking about. But certainly our unit that prosecutes dealers is extraordinarily full in work. That's for darn sure. Yeah. Yep.
I bet. Yeah.
Okay. So how does Pima County, I know you said they've been out teaching other counties how to fix this, how do they create the laws that we have here to work in different counties up the road?
Well, I think that was part of what I was trying to share up at the legislature, was that we have state laws that apply statewide. And so what I was sharing with the legislature is that we already have manslaughter on the books. In other words, you cannot sell poison to someone, knowingly profit off of it, causing their death, and go unaccounted for. Again, we're going to prosecute you and hold you completely accountable here in Pima County. And that's why we've been sharing our prosecutorial tools, if you will, and doing those statewide trainings to show how it can be done. But Sherry, I want to add, and to Emma's question as well, I gave you an example of the easiest case, right, where this woman was warning that her product was very heavy, and selling it anyway and profiting off of it. That's an easier case to prosecute. It's much harder when there's four or five things on board in a person's system. And then you have what's called a causation problem, because it's impossible to say for sure what caused a person's death. And so, you know, those aren't going to get prosecuted in a similar way. But that's why you have your experts to check for what was in the system and what caused the death.
Okay. Take, a grown adult experimenting, which I think is a dumbass thing to do, buying drugs and pretending, you know, getting high, cocaine, whatever it is. What about like this California case here? This 15-month-old child died from an overdose of fentanyl. Their parents are being charged with murder because they brought it into the house. What about the person that sold it to them? Will they also, do you think that's a possibility that they too will be charged if they know who that seller was?
I think that gets into a causation problem as well. We could think of it as like an intervening event. It's so, Sherry, we have had those cases as well, have come through the homicide panel that we have almost every Monday, where young children or babies have lost their lives because they got a hold of a pill, because children will put anything in their mouth at a certain age, as we know. And if parents are bringing that in and being reckless, they're going to get charged accordingly. The seller needs to be held, if you can track back to the seller, they need to be held accountable for selling, but it's going to be hard to, it would be hard, generally speaking, I think, to prove that you knew that there were children in the home and that the parents would be reckless with it. It gets harder to, go down the chain of events. And again, that's why we've got to get education going. I know pediatricians' offices are dealing with this all the time. If they suspect that there's substance use going on, they try to do education campaigns on their own about making sure that, you know, the house is safe in every possible
way. Do they have a duty to call and report if they suspect a child has been, you know, exposed to drugs that they shouldn't be exposed to?
Oh, yes. There's mandatory reporting if they suspect an injury in a child or a toxicity in a child, you know, due to something illegal. Absolutely.
That has to be difficult.
Yeah.
This is like, yes. Okay, you're taking care of this person. So marijuana is not a fatal drug. And I think people are confused because it is addictive. And people go, oh, it's just marijuana, but it's addictive. Isn't this a stepping stone? Don't people use marijuana and then they want a bigger high, a bigger high, a bigger high? So they're just working their way up to the illegal drugs?
I think the problem is that the studies on this, I think, are really widely varied. I think when we're talking about kids and experimenting, you can see it go up in that direction, but it doesn't bear out, I think, among adults. And Sherry, what I'll say is that, at least in my limited experience, just talking about my 3.5 years now in office and looking at those homicide panels every Monday, what I will say is that alcohol brings in more cases than marijuana does. Alcohol in the system causing crashes out on our roads, alcohol in the system causing just really bad judgment and taking what should have been an argument into a full-on fight. And then, of course, you know, don't get me started on the proliferation of firearms, because the availability of firearms has had a huge impact on the homicide cases. What should have been a minor argument, then someone just reaches for a gun that's within reach, and it takes it from 0 to 60. So I guess I'm forced to focus priorities and limited resources on what causes the most harm in our community that we're seeing on a daily basis?
Alcohol and guns.
Yeah, it's a bad combination. It's a bad combination. Yes.
Absolutely. I know there's a program where you can have your, I don't know, your conviction set aside. What's the difference between a set aside and expunge?
So, and actually, Sherry, we now have a third thing, which is to seal your record. And that's a new thing. That's brand new as of just this past January, I want to say. And so we'll start with expungement. That came in with Prop 207 when Prop 207 was passed. The part that was exciting, I think, for most people was that it would allow you to expunge and get rid of a minor personal possession marijuana felony or conviction, or even just paraphernalia, of which thousands of people statewide were still burdened by old convictions that keep you from employment, from education, from housing. But that's just simple possession of marijuana, and that's really the only expungement we still have. A new sealing order came in for low-level, nonviolent felonies over a certain age, where it's old enough and you've been demonstrating good behavior ever since that time.
Oh, the activity was old enough.
Right. The conviction is old enough. And so you can get that record sealed. And the point of all of this is we want to encourage good behavior. If you find yourself involved in the criminal justice system, we want you to be held accountable, and then we want you to move on and not get stuck in the system. We want you to come back and be productive members of the community, because that's how we drive the crime rate down. That's how we have a safer, healthier community. And so if we saddle a person with a felony for life and they're branded for life and they can't get decent employment, they can't make it better through school, their housing is always vulnerable and just not good quality, then they can't really get that stable footing and come back. And we're undermining the strength of our own local economy when we do that. So these opportunities are huge, and people are taking advantage of it because they've demonstrated that they want to be good, productive members of our community.
How long does that have to be in your past?
Sherry, I'm going to have to look it up. The number 10 is popping into my head. It's a pretty limited start. I think they have to be 10 years old. And I'll look that up and shoot that back to you. But I'll give you a quick story, Sherry, that at one of my very first expungement clinics when we were new in office, there were two gentlemen who caught my eye who came in, because one of them might have well been in his 80s, and he had like a 1970 conviction, you know, for having a joint in his pocket. And I think he truly just wanted, on the principle of the matter, he just wanted it to go away finally, and he was delighted to be able to do that. But much more importantly, I think, was the young man who came in, and it was a juvenile conviction for having a joint in his pocket, but it was still messing him up because he was a highly skilled nurse. And finally getting that expunged, he said, I'm going to immediately be able to promote. They've been wanting to promote me and they couldn't because of the clearance, and I'm going to be able to immediately promote now. And he stood up and he said, thanks so much for doing this for our economy, and shook my hand. And that's huge.
That is huge.
We want people to do well. And so these are really common sense reforms that are going to make our community healthier and safer.
And they do that periodically, that down at the, the convention center?
Yes, we just did the third Fresh Start in October.
And it's called Fresh Start.
Fresh Start. But we run clinics monthly, and anyone can go to our website at pcao.gov. I'll look that up really quick. You can go to our website and fill out a form right on our website. It takes like 3 minutes, and submit it to see if we can't get you relief.
Help.
Yeah.
So what's the set aside then?
And I want to just correct myself. PCAO, as in Pima County Attorney's Office, pcao.pima.gov.
Okay.
And Sherry, the set aside. It was not effective, and that's why the legislature took it up to a ceiling, ceiling meaning SEAL, you know, to get it sealed, because you can get a certificate that says good job, but if a conviction is still living on your record and people can see it, that you just
that's
can't, you
what
can't
I was
move
gonna
on.
Ask yeah. Because I know people have had things expunged and it's still on the record, you just can't read it. It's like redacted, and that has led to more problems,
right?
Because what was it, a homicide? What'd right. you do, you know, not a simple traffic ticket,
right? You don't want it to look worse than it was. And again,
exactly.
And again, that, you know, that's why it should be completely sealed. And we also need to remember security. This isn't gonna completely disappear, right? I mean, national security clearances and things like this are going to always be able to pick stuff up, as they should. But just getting, you know, getting an apartment, or getting, you know, getting a grant to go to school, that's what we want people to be able to
being to able get. To be promoted at your job.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
Simple things. So we have fentanyl. We have marijuana, we have cocaine, we have all these things that are illegal, and
yes,
it's unfortunate that people are taking part in that. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people about the drug situation. They feel very strongly that people who sell these drugs should be accountable, held for homicide, at least. And I'm like, okay, there's accountability on both sides. Because what you did or what somebody did that you know was also illegal. Illegal drugs, it's in the name. You're buying illegal drugs. Mm. How do you, I know in tort law it's like a percentage here and a percentage there. It's, you know, very tricky. How do your people justify, or, you know, the scale of justice, how does that work?
Well, on the criminal side, most statutes are designed to where, you know, the victim's behavior shouldn't be a factor. Most statutes are written out to just hold people accountable for the harm that they have caused. But yes, it does get complicated in this arena, as we were discussing earlier, if someone overdoses or you know, often it's a heart attack or some type of catastrophic event, and they die, and if there's multiple things in their system, then you do have that causation problem, and it can become harder to hold people accountable. But that's holding people accountable at the highest order for homicide. You know, there's Our drug laws for selling high levels of narcotics are going to get you in a heck of a lot of trouble and doing significant prison time anyway, and that's where the bulk of the work is going on.
Do you think doubling or making it more severe, jail time more severe, you know, financial fine would help stop or slow down the sale of drugs?
It hasn't historically, and I think that's the real tension, is that the war on drugs, it just was a terribly failed policy. It just, that went on for decades and decades, and it just hasn't gotten us where we need to go. We have to and it's three times as expensive. You know, we had the most expensive system in the world. We incarcerated the most people in the world, you know, as if Americans were the most evil people in the world, right? You know, and it wasn't rational, and it wasn't data-driven or solution-oriented. You know, we were paying a fortune, an absolute fortune, to incarcerate the heck out of everyone and not getting anywhere.
Like
not
spinning your wheels.
It's spinning your wheels. That's precisely right. And so we have to start making those investments in what causes the demand. You know, the sickness that causes the demand. And at its root cause, you know, investing in children. You know, again,
education.
Right. Pay for education on the front end and take care of our children in a holistic way. You know, give them good nutrition, good schooling, good medical, so that we're not just building more prisons. You know, at the end of the day, we need smart on crime, not tough on crime.
I remember my dad telling me when this came to light in my household. And it was on the news, and I was watching the news with my parents, which I didn't usually watch the news, but I was in grade school. And my dad looked at me and said, "Don't ever do that." It was about somebody who was taking drugs, and I don't remember what happened to him. He said, "You're smarter than that, and it will ruin your life."
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Yeah, I think kids need to be educated at a young age because that's kind of how they grow up. And if they're kind of taught and it's kind of drilled into their head as at a young age, they won't even want to do it when they're older. And like putting this in school programs, I feel like too is important, because if you don't have a parent who's telling you not to do it, if you have someone at school telling you not to do it, it could make a huge difference with how you're educated and how you think about drugs growing up.
Emma, I think that's those words are so wise. There was a study that came out recently in the juvenile world that said that one positive adult in a child's life is enough to make a huge difference, mm-hmm. that they can show that in the data. And it does not have to be a parent.
Mm-hmm.
It's one really good person, teacher, coach, that intervenes for a kid and shows the way, right? Models good behavior, educational, someone that the child can trust and talk to about problems and stresses, makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, completely.
Now, I told you about we used to have a program called Real Kids Productions.
Mm.
And I remember I was doing the program. I just kind of fell into it. Doing the program, had a lot of kids involved with doing TV shows. And one day the phone rang and it was a judge. And he said, "I've got this young man. He did something that, you know, something stupid. And he has to do community service." And I said, "Okay, who are you and where'd you get my number?" Because I didn't believe him. And anyway, I took on this kid. I told him I have zero tolerance. I'm not fit for this. I don't think I'm qualified for what you're wanting me to do, but okay. So I went and I talked to the child. He was a high school kid. Talked to him and told him to be at the studio what time, and he said he couldn't get there because he had no ride. I went and picked him up every week. I would go and pick him up, and he never, ever missed. And one day, I don't know what he did, but one day I did ask him, "Where are your parents?" Parents were either drunk or drugged up and passed out and sometimes not home. One's in prison. One time he told me he's in jail. And so he did his time and learned how to do TV stuff. He was really, really good at what he did. And when his time was up, I said, "Hey, you completed everything." I contacted the judge, told him what happened. And he just looked at me very, you know, like, "That means I can't come back." I said, "No, you can come all the time, you know, every week if you want."
Mm-hmm.
And so I would go pick him up. I always made sure I fed him before I took him home.
And that's wonderful, Sherry.
Just, you know, just something for him to, he had a voice.
Yep.
And he was productive. And we did a lot of TV shows. We did a lot of interviewing people. They did a comedy show.
Wow.
The kids did what they wanted to do. It gave them something to do, too.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, absolutely.
And it would, we'd still have that program today, but the city of Tucson, without notice, closed down the TV station.
Oh, no.
So it was like overnight. Okay, sorry, guys. We have no program anymore.
Well, and Sherry, I think you just made an amazing pitch for Big Brothers, Big Sisters. I know that they are in constant need of the bigs, you know, especially Big Brothers. That's often a long wait list where kids are really hoping to be matched. those programs, you know, and you and the judge invented your own little.
He gave over the course. I had three kids.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And no, I didn't.
Can you say which judge?
I don't remember his name. Okay. But I remember I didn't believe him. I almost hung up on him. It says, "Who are you? Mm-hmm. What do you want?" But, you know, yeah, I think people need to just, like, reach out, especially with the kids, to educate the kids.
Absolutely.
Let them know that, you know, this is not the road you want to go down.
Right, right.
It's a mistake. And right. The same thing with guns. Mm. Yeah, don't get me started. Don't get me started. Yeah. No, we need to do a better job. What would your suggestion be, Emma?
For educating?
Educating kids.
I think just having some speakers come into classrooms, I think, would go a long way. I remember when I was in elementary school, we had guest speakers come in. I went to Catholic school, so we kind of did that every year.
And so you speak Latin too?
No, I wish. But we had them come in and they would tell us, I remember from K through 8th grade, it was every year, and they would always tell us and we would get it drilled in our heads in high school. We kind of started a little bit in the lesson plans about drugs as well, too, but it wasn't really something that I grew up around. But I think that kids who are less fortunate, that maybe do grow up in troubled households, are especially given those grants and access to those educational programs about drugs. It could do so much more than we think it could.
And you know what? I think it you know, it's nice that law enforcement goes in and they have their uniform on and everything, but I think it needs to be everyday people.
Yeah,
right.
People not
right.
in uniform
yeah,
need to be saying the same thing.
Yeah,
right.
And, you know, and it could be an undercover cop. I don't care. Just people need to be putting that message out there, and they need to read it all the time.
Yeah.
In all their books. And we do these. We're doing next week. I think it's next week is December 3rd. We'll be doing a presentation at Pima Federal Credit Union on Oracle Road. If you want more information, send me an email, because I'm not sure it's even on our website yet. Mm. But we're going to be talking about scams and artificial intelligence.
Excellent.
And we're going to be explaining to people how to protect yourself, especially when it comes to money matters. Mm-hmm. Please, please, please don't fall for the scams.
That, Sherry, I wholeheartedly thank you for doing that, because that is an area also where prevention goes such a long way. We can teach, you know, our fraud unit prosecutes, obviously, and we have a new fraud unit, and when they hit the 1 year mark, they had already captured $1 million in restitution for victims.
Wow.
But I really think it's the work that we do out in the community, teaching people how to avoid scams, how to realize it's happening, so you can just shut it off, frankly, hanging up the phone or deleting the email. It goes such a long way to preventing it from ever happening.
So I know people are so astute to what's going on that they'll just screw with the people. If they're on the phone, they'll just, you know, string them along, ruin their day. But yeah, you need to be careful. And the best thing is just hang up or don't answer. If you don't recognize the number, don't answer.
Right, right.
And if there's a pause, I'll pick up the phone, because I have to with my job. I have to pick up the phone. And if there's a pause, hang up.
Right.
You know, because that's some call center probably, and somebody who doesn't need to be talking to you that day. So,
the two key things to always have is, you know, a loved one or a good friend that you trust to run an idea by. You know, don't make a large purchase. Don't make an unplanned purchase without running it by them and talking it out. And number two, if you're worried about a loved one, if it's one of those scams where they're pretending to be a loved one, you take control. You call them back. You call their mom. You call their brother. And do your own investigation before taking action. Just slow it down. That's what we always just say, slow it down. Because the scammer always is urgent, and it's right now, and I need you to pay this right now. It's always urgent. And we
and
tell
don't
people
hang
to
up
slow
while
down.
We go to the store and buy those gift cards, because I want to talk to you the whole time.
Right, yeah. Right.
So it's so many cases.
Yeah.
You know, it's not cool. So what words of wisdom? We've got 1 minute left. What words of wisdom do you want to leave our people with?
Oh, that's a tall order, Sherry. I think, you know, we've covered so many topics today, and I'm gonna back it out and just go really, really high level. I think a lot of what we talked about today is stress and anxiety and grief coming from a couple of really hard years for the country. And I think that truly, the more we check on each other and reach out to each other and try to restore personal connections, is going to be healthier for the whole community. And that's in the prevention area and working with children and everything we talked about today.
Very cool. Very cool. Thank you for coming in. Thank you, Emma, for being here.
Yeah.
And thank you for listening. And until next week, shop local and stay safe.